Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So as usual, I've opened the front door and grabbed the first two likely-looking Londoners who happen to be out there.
It does seem that everyone's got a story to tell.
I think screaming does help as well.
Ooh, yes, the Horniman Walrus.
They dug out bodies in 1887, 1873.
What did he look like when he came out the other end of that?
Knackered.
Got Sarah Palin coming. How do you feel about that?
A little bit pathetic.
So we're in the parlour of Dr. Johnson's house.
One sees a story that is both of protest and of coming together.
So they're banning people from bringing food to homeless.
Yeah, they're banning soup runs.
You know, we weren't buckled by the terrorism.
A word in your eye, don't worry or push. A step in the gate is worth two in the bush.
Which area of ridiculousness do we start on with that story? Why would you give a medal to a pigeon?
Listen, you're all idiots. You don't understand culture or anything.
No running, no throwing. This is pretty serious stuff.
You engage with other people, you link across to other people.
It's just huge. It's gigantic.
How many times have you done this so far?
That depends.
What do you think of that approach?
I think that's terrible.
London life is a really rich experience, and there's a lot that's good about living here.
Boris Johnson.
He weighs as much as 40 school children.
What a peculiar conversation. Hello, it's Friday, November the 23rd, 2012. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and this is Londonist Out Loud, a podcast of news, views and curiosities from London, UK. You can download the show free on iTunes, hook up on Facebook at Londonist Out Loud, or tweet me at Londonist Sound. Well, Sam Lee has, we have agreed, the portfolio career that we so often find ourselves talking about on this show. He is a Mercury Prize-nominated folk singer, promoter and animateur, and he released his debut album, Ground of Its Own, last June 2012. Some of the backstory here to your working life is quite amazing as well, Sam. Apparently, you have been a trained visual artist, a teacher of the wilderness survival techniques, and you have moonlighted as a burlesque dancer before embarking onto a journey of the old songs of the British Isles, and you're currently trying to change preconceptions of traditional folk music. Wow, that's quite a playful.
Yeah, I played around with a few things before I settled on the folk music, but I'm kind of trying to reappraise what contemporary ideas and expectations are of folk music.
We'll be digging into what that means in just a moment. We are currently practicing our survival skills at the Very Easy to Survive Cafe Oto in Dalston, and the founder and manager, Hamish Dunbar, is here as well. Hi, Hamish.
Hi.
This is quite a gaff you got here. Very, very relaxing sort of place. I've never been here before. I see Italian Vogue has said that this is the coolest place in the universe or something, some huge accolade like that.
I've heard that. I don't think anybody's actually seen that article. I think it's become part of folklore. But my subscription lapsed a while back, so I'm not entirely sure. But that's, apparently, a few years ago.
The connection here, of course, is that Sam Lee, as a musician, you're getting ready to perform here, and you're quite a supporter of the live music scene in London generally, Hamish. What sort of acts do you find yourself presenting?
Well, I started the space here with my partner Keiko getting on 4.5 years ago, and I mean, the program's pretty diverse, but I suppose you would say it's all what people sometimes refer to as underground music or experimental music. Certainly not... not mainstream music. We try and put things on which don't tend to find sympathetic spaces in the rest of the city. So it's kind of a little haven for things that yeah, maybe would struggle elsewhere, and we try and kind of create a space for that. The program's quite international as well. It's always drawn quite heavily from Japan, which where my partner Keiko comes from. We do quite a lot of residencies with international musicians and kind of hook them up with UK-based players, and they come and play several nights on the trot. So yeah, the program's diverse, but it's all within that kind of field.
So Sam, this is an exciting platform, and no mistake.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a real gem in London, if not the musical world. I think what's so exciting is that it's a very experimental lineup, and you know the risk taking that happens within promoting is huge. So having a space that kind of continuously programs music that a lot of people would not have heard about otherwise, yet has been so successful, and it's such a regular, you know, filter capacity plays this, the people take the risk, and I think it's revived a scene that's been kind of very, very continuous in London of experimental music and experimental jazz and all that, those sort of threads, and really kind of seen a massive expansion of it here.
Right, yeah, that's very important, isn't it, to be approaching music with a genuinely open ear, I suppose, and not be just looking for kind of prepackaged stuff fresh off the conveyor belt.
Yeah, I think it's really funny because Hamish and me actually, by sheer coincidence, went to art school together and have then both gone off to this acoustic world. And I think seeing the success of somewhere like Cafe Otto is very important for a musician to see that taking risks in music can be successful, and I've approached my music in a very experimental, very kind of off the beaten path sort of mentality. And I think, you know, part of having the confidence to do that comes from seeing a community that embraces those sorts of experimentations.
Well, building on that then, let's talk about audience then, because your mission is to try and knock down some of the preconceptions about traditional folk. I've got to say, one of the first preconceptions that I might have is that there's much less of an audience for it than for almost all other forms of music. What are the challenges that you have there in terms of reaching people and showing them what folk music is?
Yeah, well, I'm a bit of an evangelist in that sense, and my attitude as a promoter, because I put on music nights under the Nest Collective, and we have actually put concerts on here before, is that I'm trying to preach to the unconverted, and convert people who have assumptions or you know, think they don't like folk music, as was pretty much the kind of the common attitude 6 years ago when I started, For me, it's actually, you know, it's wonderful music. It's a music that reaches people in a very different way that a lot of other musical forms do. It goes straight to the heart, straight to the soul. And I think a lot of people have quite emotional reactions to folk song, traditional music. But it's all about, you know, it's all about the packaging, and it's all about the PR. And I believe firmly in, you know, you've got to update the presentation, and you don't necessarily have to change the music. I will put on deeply traditional unaccompanied singers alongside some real kind of, you know, soundscapist, and I work on the new folk, old folk, no folk concept, the kind of Trojan horse. You get stuff in that people are comfortable with and is within their comfort zone, and then I'll throw in some real gems and some real kind of, you know, out of the box sort of stuff, and people will be thrilled to suddenly be invited and be introduced to kind of, you know, something different.
And Hamish, you're obviously reaching further than just folk. You're working with other musical forms as well. You're working with art installations and so forth. But how much of what Sam is saying here is resonating with your approach?
I mean, totally. I mean, we do have, there is a sort of strand of folk music that happens at Cafe Otto, some quite traditional folk forms. I mean, what I like about folk music is it's kind of very, it's very direct, and it transcends, I suppose, what Sam's talking about, which I suppose resonates with this place, is it kind of transcends any notion of kind of fashion or anything that's very transient like that, and it's really about the kind of the core of that music and the kind of inherent kind of beauty or kind of power of the music, and that's what kind of I'm interested in, is kind of stripping away all the kind of stuff that comes with it and actually just being quite open to the process of kind of listening. And I think what this venue does is it's always a space where people really listen and engage with what's happening, and the kind of stuff that goes with that is kind of with sometimes how that stuff is presented in the press or whatever is kind of stripped away, and you're trying to have quite a direct engagement between the performers and the audience. And this space really kind of lends itself to that, because there's no stage and people sit very, very close to the people performing. And there's a kind of intimacy that lends itself very well to folk music, but also other types of music like free jazz or more experimental electronic music or really anything that kind of benefits from that kind of direct engagement between a performer and an audience.
That's very interesting what you say about not having a stage. It does remind me a little bit of the interwar German bistros with the cafe tables, and you half expect a singer to be passing in amongst them. What about Dalston? You founded the place. How long ago did you found the cafe?
4.5 years ago. I mean, we were sort of... we got a lease on this place, I think, 5 years ago, and there was a period when we were doing some work to it because it was in a bit of a state.
And tell me about the changes that you've seen. Sam, you're a Dalston resident, and you've got the establishment here in Dalston. It's beginning to get a reputation, if it hadn't already got one, as one of the very trendy parts of town. What sort of changes have you seen in the time you've been here?
It's been a really interesting change. I think it's expanded in every respect. There are more dirty nightclubs filling up on Saturday night with, you know, and the streets are, you know, have more broken glass on it than they used to. But there's also more cultural institutions. There's the Arcola Theatre's now moved in next door to here, and there are more creative spaces, more music venues springing up everywhere. So I think it's kind of everything expands. The market is, the Ridley Road market is still full of wonderful fruit and veg and a really rich Jamaican, Montserratian community, Asian community, African community. And I sort of feel like there are many positive changes that are happening here. Yet it's also becoming a popular destination on Friday, Saturday nights. And, you know, you may want to steer clear of the high street at those particular times. But ultimately, having spaces like this and the confidence for other promoters and to start opening their spaces up for music, for art showings, for restaurants, for food, you know, all that sort of thing is a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's changed a lot, but I think you could kind of smell that change coming even when this was open. And I mean, it's, you know, that Vogue article that you referenced earlier, I think that had as much to do with the space, where we happen to be located as to the space itself. I'm not even sure, you know, whether they even came here or anything, or whether it was just this, you know, there was this space that happens to be in this very hip area. I feel quite removed from quite a lot of that stuff. I think we plough a very particular kind of furrow here, and we do what we do, and I try to kind of be quite blinkered in some respects to just kind of focusing on our program making that's as interesting as we can, and who comes through the door comes through the door. There was an article recently on us in the Guardian, and it was all these sort of comments below were very they were quite attacking of what we were doing, and I think a lot of that had to do with actually the association of the area and all this sort of that it's full of hipsters and things, and actually a typical cafe audience is very, very different from that, and it's very diverse and
Could we just dig a little deeper into that? Because I've certainly heard that myself, the idea that the sort of the Shoreditch, Hoxton, Dalston hipster type scene is somehow inherently suspect or transient or not real or something like that. What's the basis of that, and what's the counter to it?
I think we've become associated with that to some extent, just as I say, because of where the location is. But I mean, as I said, the audience for this place is often very mixed in terms of age and background, and that's really important to me. It's really important that it feels an accessible place for absolutely anybody that wants to come and listen to things. In terms of a wider kind of comment on that scene, I don't know. I mean, and I think these words have been used so much now that whatever currency they've had have kind of become slightly redundant. I'm not sure what a lot of it means a lot of the time.
I think it comes down to the quality of the music that's happening, and if an audience are going to sit through 2.5 hours of free experimental jazz or old folk music or whatever, and come away with having a great experience, then good on them. Doesn't matter what they're wearing or where they were brought up. I think ultimately it's very easy to pick fun at these hipsters and these trendies, but places like Otto and the Vortex and I like to think the Nest, we don't we don't make our programming fit our audiences. We're quite single-minded in picking what we think is high quality and challenging. And, you know, there'll be nights when nobody comes because it's too challenging, and there'll be nights when it's filled up. And I think that's a, that has to remain paramount, I think.
Yes, that's it. I strongly think that some of those scathing comments or attacking comments that you mentioned, Hamish, they come from fear, don't they? Somewhere along the line, this is an audience or members of an audience that are just a little bit scared to try something different, try something new. So when they're seeing an area, perhaps it's got a reputation for everybody trying something new, I think that makes people fearful.
You know, I something that I console myself with, because I can be quite we all have our insecurities. When I'm, you know, doing in some trendy spot in Dawson on a Saturday night, and I think, you know, I'm one of the coolest people in the world and the coolest place in the town, blah blah blah, and I look around the room and think, God, everyone's so bloody cool. And actually, it's like, well, I'm a bit of an oddball. You know, I would never think of myself as being cool. I've, you know, my passion is English traditional music. I spend my happiest times with Romany gypsies, learning about, you know, very, very kind of esoteric stuff. And I look around the room and think, well, I actually have no idea what are the inspirations, what are the motivations, what are the things that moves the people in this room the most. And just because we're all here under the auspices of it being, you know, fabulous and fun, actually I'm sure there's some people with some very kind of special, unique, or very kind of run-of-the-mill interests, and who are we to judge?
Well, that's it. I think as soon as you're a little way off from a bunch of individuals, they look like a group. But as soon as you get close, you start to see differences, and you start to see perhaps where you can fit in and what's to be had there. Speaking of what's to be had there, what's to be had here tonight and over the weekend?
Well, tonight we have a 70th birthday celebration of Mike Cooper, who's he's a slide guitarist. He's kind of coming out of a folk tradition, but it's he also plays in improvised context as well. It's funny that should be what's happening when we're speaking to Sam here, because it's something that straddles two worlds that we're both kind of interested in. It's surprising actually how often that those worlds of folk music and improvised music and experimental music do collide. And I think there's a strong sort of vein of obviously improvisation within the folk tradition, which is an interesting one.
Hamish, I desperately want you to stay with us for the entire show, but I know that you've got a cafe to run.
Yeah, I might slip away and make some tea, but nice to talk to you. Anyway.
It's great to have you. Before you do go, I just want to check out, because in a moment I'm going to be asking Sam Lee about moonlighting as a burlesque dancer. What's your employment dark secret? What job have you done that is the one you publicise least?
I spent some time in Japan, and for a while I was being shipped around as a Father Christmas, because they wanted a non-Japanese person turning up to all these schools dressed as a Father Christmas. So I was zooming around schools around Japan dressed as Father Christmas, which is not something I wish to do again, but was quite entertaining for a while.
Oh, seek and ye shall find. So that people can find details of all the upcoming bits and pieces here at Cafe Otto, what's the best website?
It's cafeotto.co.uk. It's Otto with one T. that's got all our details on it. And also, you can subscribe to our e-flyers on that as well and find out what we're up to.
Well, Hamish Denbar, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Well, one man standing, but he's got survival skills, so he's going to be fine. What about these survival skills? You're teaching people to survive, is this right?
Yeah, well, I survived my childhood, thank God, spent lots of time outdoors, and was always a great, great lover of nature. Even though I grew up in Kentish Town in central London, for me, my happiest times are always outdoors, and was fascinated by the plant world, the tree world, and subsistence culture within indigenous communities and around the world, which kind of led into my love of British folk when I kind of discovered it. But I learned as much as I could, trained with Ray Mears, and then kind of, you know, spent much of my summers teaching and guiding, foraging, that sort of thing.
So what is the germ of that interest? How do you first realise that you want to not go down to Sainsbury's for your dinner, but instead want to look in a bush?
Well, there were a few...
Sorry, that completely belittled the... I didn't mean to do that at all. But genuinely, I can't imagine what the first step into that is.
Well, you've got it you've hit the nail on the head, actually, that there is a world of sustaining subsistence beyond the cellophane Sainsbury's world that we kind of rely upon. And, you know, as a little kid, I had some seminal moments of picking mushrooms, finding giant puffballs, catching a lamprey in a river once, and then all the villagers celebrating my catching of it. It was a real kind of idyllic story from my childhood.
Did you grow up in the Middle Ages? A lamprey.
For most of the audience, we've never heard what a lamprey is. In fact, the most terrifying creatures with this kind of mouth of teeth that kind of suck onto the side of creatures. But I had all these kind of wonderful moments where I realised that, you know, that it's not just about finding food. It was about understanding the relationships the natural world has with itself, that kind of cycle of life. And I adored. The way a mushroom would grow with a particular tree and that kind of symbiosis. And the more I learned, the more the kind of the natural world kind of sprung into full colour and life. And I realised, you know, this wasn't a peaceful outdoors. It was a wonderfully noisy and communicative life where everything was dependent on each other, and there was this wonderful balance. And I kind of felt very much that I, you know, to tread carefully, but respect and how one could kind of integrate and use and feed.
How do you cope with living in a city, London?
Very well, very well. I see the same sort of relationships. I don't see the kind of quite the same cultural biodiversity as I do in a kind of Snowdonia National Park or some sort of wonderful wild environment. But I think, you know, there are a lot of similarities in the way that, you know, we as a species inhabit and integrate ourselves within our landscape. And Ridley Road Market is a little bit like, you know, the great wilds. It is a wilderness in that sense. I love getting a good bargain.
Well, I'm not sure how that all adds up at the end of the day, but there's a great depth to it. And let's dig into these preconceptions. What are the other preconceptions that people have that you're keen to overturn as far as folk music go?
Well, I think, you know, people look at it as a kind of backwards looking twiddly d music that's kind of finger in the ear, socks and sandals and beards and tankards, and those are all connotations which in some ways are very accurate in terms of a community that have kept it going and really celebrated and been in love with it, but I look at folk music, traditional music I should say, more than folk music, as being our ancestral heritage music. It's the stories and morals and tales that have inhabited our culture and have been our code and conduct by which we have certainly the greater mass of the working classes and the people who've, you know, basically the majority of the population have shared our culture and our knowledge and passed it on through the oral tradition and upheld wonderful variations in styles and languages and yarns and colloquialisms, etc., etc., of vernacular culture. And I think it's what gives the huge diversity of culture that has been in this country. And I think, you know, when you ask me what's it like being in the city, I think, you know, the great thing about being in Dalston is that there's a huge cultural diversity, but actually, you know, there's a huge monoculturalism that is sweeping through our country, and you know, I think that's something to really be conscious of.
So you're preserving the sort of the very distinct regional differences and so forth, in which case, which region does your music tend towards?
Well, I would firstly challenge the word preserve. I like the word conserve. I'm about keeping it alive and growing and evolving. I'm a little bit of an oddball because I'm an outsider. I grew up in London in this kind of, you know, malaise melting pot of everything and anything, but I don't come from Britain. I'm an Eastern European Jew who's kind of arrived in this country with my own culture, so I see everything in quite a sort of, you know, objective view. I've cherry-picked from Irish, Scottish, West Country, East Anglian, Midlands, Yorkshire, everything, and glean the best bits of it. So my approach to it is really about creating my own voice, my own approach to singing, and my own acoustic sound, because I don't sing unaccompanied, although I do occasionally. For me, my album, my creative work, is about creating a new soundscape and an acoustic framing to these ancient songs.
Do you work with Jewish traditional music as well?
It's very influenced. It's very been a great influence in my music. The cello player I work with in my band is a klezmer player. She studied both gypsy and klezmer music. So I have that influence. And I think some of my interest in the gypsy side of British music, and I'm not talking about Eastern European gypsy, I'm talking about 800 years in this country, Romani communities who sing old English songs, have brought a modality from the East. Their scales and their approach to singing harks back very much to my first musical influences, which were the cantors in the synagogues. So I think I've seen a cultural parallel of indigenous music here with my foreign yet kind of home music.
Just mind-blowing. Incredible. One of the great richnesses of this job is to be able to open a door onto an area of life that I knew nothing about at all and see so much behind it. I know we've got lots more to say as well. I have to steer us gently towards London stories. That wasn't very gentle there. That was like, wait, time for London stories.
I'll swing it back, don't you worry.
Yes, I don't. Okay, we've been looking over the stories that we've got in front of us here. The one that I think has inspired us least is this rubbish with the fire engine maintenance contract. The princely sum of £2 was the price for which the entire London fire engine fleet's maintenance contract was sold a little while ago to a company who then cocked it up, and they've passed it across to another company, and it's they're not doing very well. The transfer has been labelled as an unauthorised change of ownership. I mean, none of this is particularly exciting unless you're really into your politics, but I think it does raise the question of what is going on with the public services. We've had the police's actions called into question, people resigning, politicians obviously are always involved in one sort of scandal or another. Now it's the fire engines. Do you basically feel that there's competence going on behind the scenes here in our public services, our emergency services?
I wouldn't want to accuse the fire service of incompetence in any realm. You know, we rely deeply on them, and I haven't had direct experience with their skills and their services. However, I think what it probably suggests is another example of a very vital institution which should be protected in every possible way is suddenly being seen as just another carcass to be chewed at by some, you know, corporation that think they can make a lot of money out of, and that, you know, the incompetence is not within the fire service, it's within the private sectors who seek to try and take over.
Well, this is precisely the point, isn't it? Yes, no, nor would I dream of suggesting the fire service itself has any incompetence at all. Very brave and dedicated bunch of people. But this bit has been hived off, as with sort of private hospitals or schools under PFI and so forth. It just really undermines the whole thing, doesn't it?
I completely agree, and it's only actually when we get put into, you know, real crisis situations, which will arise, that the true metal of some of these institutions is going to be proved, and when we realise some of the massive mistakes that the government have made in the selling off, and, you know, the kind of, yeah, the selling off, the selling out.
Well, one of the things that I was listening to a conversation about a couple of days ago was the idea that we, the taxpayers, pay for infrastructure for energy, which then gets sold off to private companies, usually from overseas, who then charge us through the nose to use the electricity that we've essentially paid for already.
Well, I, you know, on a personal level, I've tried to combat that by putting wood-burning stoves in my flat and trying to stay as much off-grid as possible. I mean, you know, I try and stay out of the clasp of these sort of services as much as possible. However, I got a chimney fire about 3 weeks ago and nearly had to call the fire brigade out. So, you know, it all comes back to bite us in the end.
I've got to say, that's one of the scariest experiences I've ever had in my life, is nearly setting fire to somebody else's chimney, in fact.
Blimey, yeah, my flu started to, like a rocket, just shake and rattle, and then started to glow red in my house. I didn't know what the hell was going on. It was quite scary.
I can see why you'd be reluctant to suggest in any way that the fire brigade is anything other than completely up to scratch. Have you sorted your chimney out now?
I just let it burn itself out, and
did a bit of sweeping.
Meanwhile, another emergency service, the City of London, the Ring of Steel. As we know, the police have got checkpoints around the city, and that, I think, came in around about the time that the IRA were causing their particular form of mischief. Well, things have been changing in and around the Square Mile. This week, the force are operating unpredictable, high-impact deployments. In other words, a more visible presence of officers, along with a mix of cars, motorcyclists, dogs and other measures. And the term other measures could conceal all sorts of things. Do you drift towards the Square Mile at all, or do you steer well clear?
I have to cycle through it once a week to do my Resonance FM show. It's always a really interesting ride because I go down Bishopsgate, and in fact I go past the Pinnacle, which they've just said, you know, it's never going to be built, the Pinnacle. Great, this great hole, this great kind of rotten tooth has been, you know, not allowed to grow there. I cycled down Bishopsgate, which I remember when the sit-in demonstrations happened, and I remember we took over that corridor, and that was one of my most kind of strong memories of occupants and you know, when the banking crisis was really at the front. And this story stinks of vast amounts of money being poured into protection of the bankers, so that no tent forests spring up ever again, that any protester will ever get in there to speak out against the economic travesties that are going on in the Square Mile. And it sucks of you know, protecting the rich, really, you know, building the fortifications up. And I you know, I think it's a really tragic story, this, in that sense.
Do you detect on the horizon events, or the sort of thing you're talking about, some sort of expression of public dissent for which this is preparation?
I can't speak if there's going to be some big uprising in, and if I did know, I probably wouldn't say anyhow. but I think it's that kind of, it's the just in case, where I think in the greater scheme of things, where cuts are happening left, right and centre, and places where actually the police force should really be putting their dollar. It's such a shame. It's to protect the rich, really. And there's so much need for better policing and a better approach to policing and integration and connection with protesters in supporting and not just this kind of really violent way that they kind of sweep in. I think everything's going backwards.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because the police are clearly there to protect the state, and to the extent that they would be right to be protecting, for example, Parliament or you know, state infrastructure or something like that, that makes more or less a sort of sense to me. But the banks are not part of the state machinery. That's not what they're there for.
No, and it kind of brings into question, which has been another story, is part of the kind of private land and the private rules that govern places like Canary Wharf and now King's Cross. And actually, you know, who's in charge and where is power being devolved? It leaves a very bad taste in my mouth.
In the last couple of weeks, we've had the ability to vote for police commissioners, which I think three people in the country turned out to vote for that. Two of them spoiled their ballot paper, and we've now got police commissioners, apparently. I'm not really clear on what the police commissioners are there to do, other than take a salary. Have you any insight into that?
No, but I thought that story about them not advertising that ballot as being, and they said, well, no, we put it on our free website, which was so kind of wonderfully, it was such a great example of their complete lack of knowledge and how to do good PR. What is a commissioner doing? Is this just is just another kind of public role face, somebody who's expendable when another corruption case comes to light? I've no idea.
That's a very cynical outlook.
I'm a very cynical man.
No, it is a mystery to me exactly what that's all about. Although, I mean, there is an argument, isn't there? If they put something out in the public domain, we don't have too much trouble finding things on the internet if we want to look for them. I wonder whether a lot of people simply aren't politicised anymore. I do feel like people have been sort of lulled into a sort of an anaesthesia.
Yeah.
Besides, a lot of people have got other things to worry about them at the moment as they work four jobs to try and keep a roof over their heads.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There's a very notable apathy within the complacency, the way rules are being changed. The government is just sort of overturning so much legislation, and I think it's I think we're kind of just sitting at home and letting it wash over us, and it's very worrying actually, because you see what's going on in Greece and in Spain and Portugal, and you know the massive amounts of rioting and in a very difficult situation, and we're just kind of happily letting some really kind of worrying changes to our human rights, to the environment, to the legislation with the banks just kind of occur, and we're going to suffer for it later on. I'd love to see more direct action and the more empowerment for people to protest. It just seems like there isn't enough of reproach happening to that.
What's the big issue for you at the moment? Because I know you mentioned that you are into direct action. You believe in getting your hands dirty.
I think the climate bill being changed is probably the most worrying. I think the government's approach to planning permissions and the removal of so much of the opposition is going to have lasting consequences on the sight and sound of the countryside, the little that we have left. I think that for me is the one that kind of pains me the most in some ways, because you know the way that our countryside is going to look in generations to come is a real unknown, as climate change occurs and we're looking at mass changes through death of ash trees. So if we're losing vast amounts of forest, which is kind of makes it easier for suddenly for planning permission to be granted, I think we're going to have a real greying out of the countryside, and that is for me something that really really troubles me.
One of the things that's quite obvious about London and with a sort of a historical perspective is that it keeps getting bigger and it keeps sucking in more outlying towns and villages and expanding, and the greying out that you're talking about happens. Do you realistically see a point in the future when that is going to stop, or is it just an inevitability? Is it just a question of putting on the brakes as hard as possible but not actually being able to halt that process?
Well, I'm not in favour of expansion and growth and development. I think it's really important. However, I think it's the reasonings behind a lot of the opening up new land for development is not about the interest of population growth. It's about feathering the pockets of big developers who've got interests, and the government have interests with, because they're all in each other's pockets. There's huge amounts of land that can be redeveloped, and reapproaches to how we redevelop inner city urban areas that are in decline. So I think there's two very separate issues going on here. Yeah, we need to develop land, but I think we need to be very careful on whose benefit that's in. I mean, look what's happening in Ireland, and there's massive amounts of whole council estates, whole housing estates that are being destroyed now because there's nobody there to move in because of the economic crisis there. That could happen if as a kind of legacy of these ghost towns left in this country. I don't know, I'm not an expert on the economics of it, but do we need fields turned into houses?
That's a fairly big question, isn't it? I feel that's one of those questions we should just leave to hang for a moment in the air here at Cafe Arte. Do you know what? In honour of you being on the show, our question to readers of Londonist this week was, what's been your most memorable musical moment in London? And here are some of the responses. I don't know, Sam Lee, if you might like to pick out one or two of your favourites here.
You know, it's a funny list. It's really interesting how many people have kind of paid a 70 quid ticket to go to the Albert Hall, and that is their greatest musical experience. And there's a lot of kind of generic answers, but actually the two ones that I think are really what about experiencing music is Kevin Phillips going to my son's acoustic gig and hearing him sing in front of an audience for the first time. Just that's where emotion and pride and simplicity is so brilliant. And it's right next to going into the summer of 2011, first trip to London, and being in Leicester Square and hearing a saxophone player, probably a busker, playing. And it's that kind of those are sort of experiences that we walk past as we're when we've bought our 150 quid ticket for the Rolling Stones. You might be passing by the most emotionally kind of rich and rewarding experience. That Joni Mitchell song Played Real Good for Free, about her stepping outside her concert hall, and there's this saxophone player playing the most amazing tune. And it's just like, do we miss some of the most wonderful experiences? And I think actually London's full of music. The buskers are wonderful. the impromptu kind of musical guerrilla experiences you get. So just go and stand on the St. Paul's Cathedral on a Sunday morning and bathe in the bells. That is phenomenal. That is just, you know, can cure diseases, that experience can.
We've got some phenomenal variety here as well. Get this for a a mixed group. Sharon Louise says, my first time in a black church, Kennington Community Fellowship, the song service was a cappella and I sang as loud as I wanted without hearing my own voice at all. Heaven on earth. Meanwhile, Andy Bungay says, I was a participant in a military tattoo in 1981. Summer's morning, about 7:30 a.m, briefly locked in a room with 9 bagpipers getting steam up, turning up suited and booted for a Tony Bennett concert at the Albert Hall. We've got the Albert Hall again there. And realising from the demeanour of the crowd, I was a night early and they were waiting for Black Sabbath. We've got here Ingo Pless, who says, I was managing a Swedish glam rock band in Dublin Castle sometime in the 90s, a band totally absent of musical influence. And it was a ploy to kiss them all before the crowd somehow backfired. We all felt awkward. Not sure I completely understand what happened there, but it sounds like a disaster. Finally, Mike Patterson, London historians, of course, old friend of the show. My worst moment was giving busking a go in tube stations in the early 80s. I was crap. Best moment, both Shepherd's Bush Empire, Rodriguez, about 5 years ago, Buddy Guy, about 10 years ago.
Oh, great. You know, great. That's brilliant. I tell you, I'm really lucky. I live in the Verger's flat, the caretaker's flat of St. Mark's Church, just off in Dalston. And it's an Anglican church. And I'm not religious, but I just rent this room connected to two of the halls. And on Sundays, you get the West African services, you get the Jamaican services, and you get the another African kind of denomination, Pentecostal. And you get all these different musics and rhythms kind of bleeding through my flat, and it's just incredible. I feel like I'm doing this kind of world tour of religious ethnic music. It's phenomenal.
I was just to, I don't think this will worry you at all, but it would have the capacity to worry a weaker-willed person. I was talking to somebody who bought a house which was like called the old parsonage or something like this, and they bought it and moved in, and then they got a bill for many, many tens of thousands of pounds to fix the church up the road. And apparently this is perfectly normal in houses that are sort of associated with the church, that you are liable to fix up the church.
And quite right too. Yeah, I think we should all be reliable. You know, I'm as I say, I'm not even Christian, but I think churches are such wonderful spaces, and a lot of churches, particularly around here, are putting themselves over as music venues and bringing back the community centre aspect. And I think that's great. We should be taking care of our churches.
Another place that perhaps doesn't get cared for as well as it should is the Abbey Road crossing of Beatles fame. Of course, we know that picture of them crossing the road, some with shoes, some without, etc. etc. But there's a spanner in the works now.
There's another Abbey Road has opened up, and why not? There's loads of abbeys and there's loads of roads. Why should Abbey Road that we know, hold that name as its own?
Well, the argument goes something like, Americans will get lost if we do this. It's not just, we should say, another Abbey Road. There are already 11 Abbey Roads in London, but this is an Abbey Road station. And of course, if you're coming to London, you're going to think that that's the one to get off at if you want to see where the Beatles lived.
I think that's the best PR stunt I've ever seen, and I hope it increases the tourist trade in, where is it, out in Stratford somewhere, because they need visitors now.
What I really liked was, yes, you're quite, what I liked was this. One local news agent reports that he's having to break the bad news to around a dozen disappointed visitors every day. I think we need to speak to that man.
I think he should get a zebra crossing set up and open a little recording studio. This guy could make a fortune.
Before I get letters in, by the way, I know they didn't live there. It was a turn of phrase, okay? A turn of phrase, I tell you. We've got a new bridge coming in Battersea. It's one step closer, apparently. 2014. Now, I know this interests you because you're a keen cyclist. Are you an almost evangelical cyclist, to use your word?
I'm a believer in it. Although I don't always cycle, it's the king of transports.
Why? It's much more dangerous now. They've just released figures, haven't they, saying that accidents on bikes have gone up 50%.
Yeah. And is that because there are so many more cyclists and slightly unqualified ones on rather terrible Boris bikes? I don't, you know, who's is this happening to your kind of, you know, strapped up, lighted, booted, you know, safe ardent cyclist, or is it the drunken, you know, Saturday nighters that get on a kind of, you know, one of these free bikes and suddenly find themselves careering in the wrong gear across busy roads?
I think I detect where your argument might take you here. I was going to pick a fight with you, because you said before the show, it was like red rag to a bull time. You said that you regularly go through red lights and you have an excuse up your sleeve ready for the cops.
Well, you know, I'm firmly aware that I'm breaking the law on a regular basis. I'm not a kind of see a red light, career through it. I'm a real, you know, as a cyclist, my priority is safety to pedestrians, absolutely. However, I'm also aware, and I don't know my statistics very well, and I may be being very creative on this one, and it's got me off the hook with police officers who've been sympathetic to this, but I think I'd be right in saying that most fatalities happen to, the majority happen to women. The majority of women will not pass through red lights. They're more likely to stay at a red light and wait till it's green. And I think that most accidents happen at that time where the lights turn, and a cyclist who is most unsteady at that point is vulnerable to big trucks turning left, all that, you know, caught on corners between buses and that sort of thing. So my view is, if the road is clear, you get through the red light, and then you're not putting yourself in the most dangerous situation, which is starting up when vehicles are overtaking you and that sort of thing. So it's in our interest in the end.
Damn, I'm pretty persuaded, I've got to admit.
I'm a very persuasive sort of person.
Yeah, I think you might. Now, okay, the test of this, the acid test of this, is if you're on a road at night and there's a set of traffic lights, you know, the ones that go red at just the wrong moment, and there's no good reason for it, anything like that. Do you cycle through those?
It depends. What's, I'm a very
you massively cycle through those.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Of course I do. And I think I'm not braking for no reason and then start, you know, I've got to conserve your energy.
Well, I've got to put up a spirited defence here. What about the law?
Well, I think
I'm talking to a direct action Occupy expert.
We are just on Dalston Junction, yeah? I've never seen the red lights occur where a car hasn't jumped those red lights at high speed, and I will regularly go up, and when a car actively jumps the red light, go and get in front of that car and let them know they've just jumped a red light and they're driving dangerously. I think there should be far more. The police would do, and we'd save so much more money if we were to prevent accidents than the cost of the NHS bill and the consequences of accidents. That actually, if we were to start putting measures to protect cyclists and solve the problem, economically it's far more in the public purse's interest.
Right, accidents are definitely going up, so you're trying to avoid being another statistic in that figure. How about looking at it down the other end of the telescope, which is an increasing number of cyclists, it seems to me, feel at liberty to break the road rules, and hey presto, the accident statistics are going up. Perhaps shouldn't it be something more like we get a law in place, or a set of laws in place governing the road, that everybody's happy with, that enshrines the safety of cyclists? Like, you know, in some countries you're allowed to turn left or right because it's the other side of the road at a stop signal, things like that, that just free up the flow of traffic and make things safer.
It's a really complicated situation, this, and there are so many other road laws in different countries that work better that we could employ. I think the issue with statistics is that, as I say, the statistics about road casualties incorporates such a vast number of different types of road users. And yeah, the tragic ones are where, you know, a regular commuter cyclist who is invariably safe is caught by a negligent heavy goods vehicle. But actually, there's so many terrible cyclists, you know, kids on their little BMXs careering through the place, you know, who get hit, and suddenly they increase the statistic because they are crazy users. Now, they might have gotten hit by a car, they might have also gotten shot or overdosed on drugs or whatever. You know, there's so many ways that, you know, they're risk takers, and to lump all cyclists into one, and you know, is a kind of is a is you know it's nonsensical. So you've got to kind of find rules that work for everything, and maybe the rules in some ways are fine as they are, and maybe the best thing is for cyclists just to continue to break the law, and there just be, you know, a slightly softer approach from police, and, you know, pick out the ones that are obviously endangering other people's lives. But if you want to take your own life into your own hands, so be it.
Well, I'm glad we've come to an exact agreement with each other.
Have we? I don't think anybody will ever agree on this.
No. One thing we can agree on, the sculpture outside... No, in fact, there's even controversy over this. We couldn't quite agree whether this is, in fact, somebody relieving themselves outside City Hall. The rumour that we spotted on last week's show has turned out to be entirely with foundation. There is a sculpture now made out of porcelain, appropriately enough, and it's celebrating World Toilet Day, which was the 19th of November, and it's outside City Hall, as I say, a fellow taking a poo
with great posture, I must add. You know, none of that kind of sitting upright as though you're at a school desk. You know, he's properly squatting, extending his colon, which I think is the, you know, the ancestral way that one should relieve themselves.
This seems to matter to you.
As somebody who has pooed in the woods on many an occasion, I know there's nothing more rewarding than that feeling of, you know, having really gotten down onto your heels, you know, leant forward, and the satisfaction from that. Yeah.
I don't know how the hell I do the sponsorship announcement after that. You might be interested to know that the statue itself is sponsored by Domestos, appropriately enough. Without any link implied or explicit, our sponsors this week, as ever, are audible.co.uk. If you want to get a free digital audiobook, and why wouldn't you, then you can do so. They've got 60,000 of them sitting there waiting for you to pluck one as you see fit. And you can also sign up for a 30-day free trial of the Audible service. I use this. I think it's absolutely fantastic. I may have mentioned before, I'm working through Hilary Mantel's oeuvre at the moment, and it's great to be able to sit there and be read to. You can play your audiobook on iPads, iPods, iPhones, everything, basically, and you can burn it to a CD and keep it forever. And it's yours whether you decide to stay on with your trial period or not. All you need to do to get that free audiobook is to go to www.audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through. Well, Sam Lee, we're right up against the clock, it turns out. There's a lot of art, a lot of really interesting art going on here. We've got a phone box shrine to Sherlock Holmes at St. Bart's at the moment. Well, it's a shrine, I should say, to the Sherlock Holmes that appears on the TV. So all a bit peculiar and...
Too involved.
Too involved, yes, exactly. Something that I think is really to be trumpeted is Victoria Park being voted the favourite park, not just of London, but of the UK.
Great, good on it. It's the oldest park in London, and it's a beautiful one. I have kind of a personal connection to it, that it was very popular with the Jewish community back in the kind of early 20th century, and my grandparents strolled there much in their day, and it's great for cyclists. There's no signs telling where you can go and where you can't go and all that business, and it just feels like a very free, relaxed, and a park with a great sense of openness to it.
Yes, totally agree. And they've tarted it up as well, of course, since the Olympics was in town. Check out the cafe down there. What's it called? The begins with a P, I think. Well, anyway, find the lake with the fountain. Find the little cafe there. Pagoda
Cafe?
Pavilion. It's the Pavilion.
We were close.
Yes, the Pavilion Cafe. They do a mean breakfast. Very good there. The other thing worth mentioning is Death, a self-portrait at the Wellcome Collection. Now, I was down there just the other day, really worth a visit. Of course, we recorded at the Wellcome a few weeks ago, but the exhibition, well, it's something to behold, not least for one of the funniest pieces I think I've ever seen, which is a very realistic, kind of disemboweled body that's missing limbs and so forth, made out of wax, very, very realistic, sitting in a hunched over position with its guts hanging out. And the title of this piece is Are You Still Mad at Me?
They've always had a really kind of creative strand to their exhibitions. It's not always kind of, you know, classic museum exhibits. They've lots of humour, and although I haven't seen this particular one on Death, it's the Wellcome Collection, I think, is one of London's gems.
Well, we're just about there, but there is time, and you're not expecting this. We finish every week with a historical quiz, and I think as a guardian of stories and ideas and memories through your music, who better to be subjected to the historical quiz than you, Sam Lee?
I failed history at GCSE. I can't remember my kings and queens. Please don't ask me about my kings and queens.
You're not going to believe this.
Divorced, beheaded, died. Divorced, beheaded, survived.
For 1 point. Okay. We'll give you a 1 point advantage, seeing as how you've pleaded. This is how you do it with the police as well, isn't it? At the crossings.
Exactly.
Right. This Week in London, 5 questions. Monday, the 12th of November, 1974. What was seen in the Thames for the first time since 1834?
Ah, I think I know the answer to this. Was it a salmon?
It certainly is a salmon. A 9-pound salmon was caught in the Thames, the first time that a fish had been seen since 1834, and it was sent to the British Museum for identification. Improvements in the water quality were hailed.
And I will just... the reason why I know that is because I'm very fond of swimming in the river down in Deptford. The Thames is one of the greatest rivers to swim. When you get high tide, just as it's turning high, amazing. Really warm, slightly brackish, and it's phenomenal. And just the other day, I was coracling down past the Tate in this little coracle I built. And you can, in fact, see footage of it very soon. We'll be coming out. But, wow, get out on that river and use it, swim in it. It's really, really clean. One of the cleanest in Europe.
You have possibly one of the most complicated lifestyles of anybody who's been on this show.
It's pleasure-seeking, I can assure you.
Tuesday, the 13th of November, 1642. During the First English Civil War, the Royalist and Parliamentary armies face off against each other in a major battle. But where in London was that in 13th of November, 1642?
What were they fighting over?
Well, they didn't like each other much.
Did that happen? Did that happen Lincoln's Inn Fields, by any chance?
No, not a bad guess. Completely the wrong place, but you're right to be picking somewhere that's got an open space in its name. There's a tube stop there, if it helps.
Doesn't narrow down.
Not Abbey Road.
No. Was it the Aldwych?
You're not going to get this, are you?
No.
No, it was Turnham Green.
Okay.
So we've got, 2 points with your bonus point, which I'm minded to take away from you. 14th of November, this is right up your street, a royal question. 14th of November, 1973, a royal marriage takes place at Westminster Abbey. Who was getting hitched?
1973. Oh, God, was it Fergie and Prince Andrew? Was it Princess Anne?
Yes, and?
Her husband.
Yes, I can't deny that one. Captain Mark Phillips. So, that gives us the next question. 15th of November, 1977. 4 years later, they give birth to their first... Well, she gives birth to their first child, Peter Mark Andrew Phillips. Four first names. At St Mary's Hospital. Where is St Mary's Hospital?
St Mary's Hospital, is that in Sloane... kind of Blackwood Sloane Square, kind of... St John's Wood. It's kind of back of Sloane Square. It's kind of, yeah.
It's Paddington.
Paddington.
16th of November, 1961. A baby is born at Hammersmith Hospital. He would become a successful boxer, winning the WBC Heavyweight Championship, as well as becoming a pantomime celebrity. Who are we talking about?
Oh, it's got to be Chris Eubanks.
It's not Chris Eubanks.
Oh,
same era.
Same era.
Much deeper voice than Eubanks.
Give me his initial.
Well, you can have it, yes, FB, but I'm deducting half a point.
Frank Bruno.
Whose first name is, in fact, Franklin. Didn't know that.
Franklin.
Yes, okay, so by hook and crook, you've got 27 points, which puts you... I don't know how you did that. You sort of persuaded me.
Points.
Yeah, it's bizarre, isn't it? I hardly noticed that happened. I'll send this for judicial review later on, I suspect.
This explains why I've never been arrested at red lights or been fined. I managed to... talk/cheat my way out of it.
Yes, I feel I've been diddled. Sam, give us details of your website and upcoming appearances, because I know you're going to be here next year, but you've got all sorts of other stuff. You're on Keris Matthews' show on the BBC over the weekend.
That's true. Sunday morning, I will be doing a live session with her on BBC Six. And then I've got lots of live dates coming up over February where I start the kind of national tour. I'm in Cafe Otto on, I think, the Friday, the 15th of February. And we're doing kind of four shows in London over that week. Cecil Sharp House, the Bedford in South London, and the Tabernacle West London. And you can find out everything about me on samleesong.co.uk, and you can find out more about the album there as well.
And where can we see pictures of you in a coracle?
That will be part of a music video, my folk music video, which will be coming out with the singles later on in the year.
Good stuff, and congratulations on your recent Mercury Prize nomination as well. And I gather you're glad, because we were discussing this. Apparently, there's a bit of a curse for winners, so it looks like you genuinely seem happy to have sidestepped that one.
Absolutely. I think if I had won, the pressure on, the expectation on album two, and you know, you're kind of suddenly the most famous musician in the country. For somebody who's got a lot more work to do to establish my name and my artistic intent, I think, you know, it's great. The nomination is brilliant, but it gives me the freedom to now kind of pursue what I want to be doing without the kind of overlooking glare of the music business.
Well, congratulations on it, and Sam Lee, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, and it's been great.
And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to my guests Sam Lee and also to Hamish Dunbar. Thanks too to Bernie Barclay, Zoe Craig, Rhea Heath and Dave Haste. Theme and incidental music was by Jack Hurd and Rory Anderson, and I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.